Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the show, Jill McCluskey, the mother of a murdered University of Utah student, says that the school should be holding people accountable. Also, a Utah lawmaker proposes changes to voter-approved Medicaid expansion. And what's preventing Utah from having a functioning hate crimes law? All of that and more on the docket today. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune managing editor Sheila McCann is here. And Sheila, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
We've also got government reporter Benjamin Wood. And welcome to you, Ben.
Thank you.
Finally, we've got Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. And good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning.
You can join this conversation as well. Call us with your questions and comments addressing any of the stories we're tackling today. We are at 801-355-8255, or you can post your questions at sltrib.com on the Behind the Headlines page, currently live. Sheila McCann, this week we heard from the mother of Lauren McCluskey. This is the University of Utah student who was killed on campus after she repeatedly reported harassing behavior on the part of her killer. We also heard from university officials. But Sheila, to begin with, let's lay out what Jill McCluskey had to say in her opinion piece, which was published in the Tribune on Wednesday. She was responding to recent findings announced by U of U officials and statements made by those officials. What did she have to say in this editorial?
She began by laying out pretty succinctly the main points when Lauren's friends, to start with, and then Lauren herself, were trying to communicate with housing officials, with campus police, with Salt Lake City police, with a counselor on campus, about their concerns about Melvin Rowland, who was the man who ended up killing her on campus. Jill McCluskey also ticked through where she felt connections weren't made that should have been made, actions weren't taken that should have been taken, and building up to this paragraph. Even the most charitable interpretation of these events leads to the conclusion that the university safety system was dangerously flawed and a number of individuals tragically failed Lauren. She also says, the University of Utah has neither acknowledged responsibility nor held anyone at the university accountable.
So, and again, this is in response to findings following an internal investigation by the U. What did the school determine in the wake of Lauren McCluskey's murder? I mean, what were their findings?
So there were many findings. They were widespread. One of the overarching findings was that housing officials and campus police did not recognize this case as interpersonal violence, didn't have the resources to respond to it properly, didn't have the policies to respond to it properly, didn't respond to it properly. And that broke down to findings such as they should have had victim advocates. They should have had policies that required them to determine whether a suspect was a parolee, which could have made a difference in this case, that the campus police were understaffed. There were a lot of findings, and it pervasively described people that weren't prepared to respond to this the way they should have.
Aren't those findings actually a sort of admission of something? You know, having gone terribly wrong and a certain admission of culpability. This is what Jill McCluskey in her editorial is saying didn't happen. But I guess there were comments that were made by officials as well that made her write what she wrote, which is that essentially the U could not have prevented the death of Lauren McCluskey.
Well, the report itself wasn't produced by the university, so it doesn't amount to admissions by the university.
Okay.
It was an independent team. It was former public safety commissioners. It was a woman who is the head now of a national campus police force safety group. So they were independent. They were making findings. They weren't coming up with admissions.
Hmm. Okay.
The initial response from the University of Utah was that this couldn't have been prevented. The report didn't give us information that told us this could have been prevented, which struck some people as odd, that statement in comparison with the lengthy findings in this report. Hmm. If any or many of these lengthy gaps had been filled, how can you say it couldn't have been prevented? I think that was the conflict in some people's minds.
After the publication of Jill McCluskey's comments, did the school take a different stance, reevaluate its position? What did the school have to say?
No, and if you remember when this first happened, the school was saying that actions by individual officers wouldn't be up for investigation, that the investigation would focus only on policies. And as the team was put together, that decision changed. the report does look at a lot of individual officer actions. But they have continued to say that this doesn't amount to a situation where individuals should be disciplined. The focus should be on adopting the policies, getting the training, getting the additional staff to make improvements, not on disciplining individuals.
H. David Burton, who's chairman of the University of Utah's Board of Trustees, said that this was kind of a perfect storm, meaning that meaning, I guess, that circumstances were such, it was almost like a, you know, not an act of God, but that it was so unpredictable that it couldn't have been prevented, I guess is the way that I would interpret that. I don't know if that's how it would have been widely interpreted. Robert Gerke, let's bring you, news columnist, in on this. Is this at least in part, you know, a public relations failing on the part of the university? I mean, Jill McCluskey says it's more than that, obviously.
Right.
But your comments on this.
It's at least that. I mean, I think the comments that President Watkins made about it being, you know, there's nothing they could do to prevent it. I think that's a it's just, as Sheila said, it conflicts with the facts that we see in the report, you know, and I think Jill McCluskey laying it out the way she did, in the detail she did, and as powerfully as she did, it just shows how absurd that statement was from the beginning. You know, I'm not contending that people need to be fired or heads need to roll or whatever, but you need to not shelter those people or draw a line to say we're not going to touch these people, because when you've admitted that they didn't do the jobs they were supposed to do, if they didn't have training, well, who was supposed to train them? Who was responsible for that? If they didn't look in the databases, who was responsible for doing that? And you've got to hold people accountable. And yes, to say we're going to make changes, it's almost like saying we did everything right, but now we're going to change all these things. You know, you can't. The two are just, they're incongruous. And I think that's the point that Jill McCluskey was making. And again, it's worth reading at sltrib.com because she made it incredibly powerfully.
A question that I have is whether this was about being afraid of admitting liability. You know, if the whole this couldn't have been prevented thing was sort of a legal strategy. And I'm sure that University of Utah officials would say I'm being cynical in that statement. But is there any reason to say changes need to be made, but this couldn't have been prevented along those lines?
I mean, Sheila might know more than I do about this, but my sense is that this is a public university, and so they do have some liability protections unless they were reckless and negligent. And so I think it's highly unlikely that they would be legally liable for this. But it's, you know, again, I think more than legal liability, the university owes it to the students and the parents to get it right. So it doesn't happen again. And to say that this was a perfect storm of events or a confluence of events ignores the fact that when these things happen, there are things that lead up to them. And it is a confluence of events every time something like this happens. And so, you're not going to bring her back to life, obviously. But I think that you need to look to the future and figure out to make sure this doesn't happen again. I mean, I've got a daughter that's going to be going to the University of Utah, perhaps, starting next year. And I think as a potential parent of a student up there, I think we all want to see them make sure that they're doing everything they can and have the resources and the training available to make sure that the student body's safe.
Sheila McCann, Jill McCluskey had her own policy prescriptions for university campuses to make them safer, especially when it comes to things like intimate partner violence. Can you talk about what sort of suggestions she made?
Well, one of the things she said is campuses need to be prepared to respond to these kinds of issues. She said she feels the University of Utah is behind on this, and she hopes that Lauren's case is going to be a catalyst for change there and nationwide. Dealing with domestic violence obviously was a challenge for police departments decades ago. It has taken activism, it has taken laws, it has taken political debate to move police towards responding differently to these cases, and maybe campuses are a place where that change hasn't completely happened. So one thing she says is campus police need to be prepared to protect their students, they need to listen to their students, they need to recognize these issues, as the report says. She also refers to some research that shows if you have more women in your police department, you are going to get more reports of domestic violence and interpersonal violence, and you can even see some of the incidences go down. She points out that this police force on the campus has 31 officers, 3 of them are women, and she urges hiring more women there and nationwide.
There is a, if I understand this correctly, Sheila, there's a an additional review going on at the University of Utah. Is that right? They're working on a second report examining what happened here.
So there were a lot of recommendations, and those are underway. The department is getting training in a lethality assessment. Some of the things that they knew about would have been red flags for them if they had been trained under this lethality assessment. That's underway. The university is planning to go up and ask for more money, for more officers, for a victim advocate. And this other process is underway to look more broadly at campus safety. And the same team that did this initial report is pursuing that report.
In a statement that the university released, I think maybe on Twitter, I'm not positive where it came from, but Ruth Watkins, president of the university, said that she accepts, you know, in almost in response to this commentary from Jill McCluskey, I don't think it was directly in response, but after that had come out, Watkins was quoted saying that she accepts the report without reservations, but also says the changes, you know, implemented could have made a difference. You know, I don't know. I guess is the new report going to point to additional changes beyond what has already been suggested? We don't know. I guess we'll see when that comes out. Ben Wood, you have covered – well, you did cover education for a number of years. And a question that I have for you is, has campus safety been in the spotlight the way that it is right now during your tenure covering education? Is this new ground we're covering?
It's slightly different ground than what we've been seeing in recent years. And of course, Sheila has a lot of experience here too. I mean, the Trib did a lot of reporting on sexual assaults on campus, not as much reporting on murders on campus, but of course that it's all tangential to this broader issue of student safety. And one thing that's important to remember here is Lauren McCluskey was inordinately proactive in contacting law enforcement and campus security forces. We can't expect a typical student to go to the lengths that she did. And so for this still to have happened in that scenario really raises some problematic questions here.
Okay. Robert Gerke, in just a couple of minutes, we need to head to a break, but any final comments on this story, how it unfolded, and response from the university?
Well, I mean, I think there is going to be some follow-up from the legislature changing, you know, looking specifically at a potential bill that they're calling, I guess, Lauren's Law, that would make it a crime to give somebody a gun that then is used in a crime.
Which
is what happened in this case. And there could be some other changes in terms of resources available for the police department, which I think is something that they do need to look at, because the university campus has grown significantly in recent years. And there are legitimate questions about whether, if they're spread too thin to look into somebody's background and see that they're on parole, do they need more resources? Do they need better training? And how are they going to get that? So I think will be some changes from this, and hopefully, you know, we can start laying the groundwork to prevent this from happening again.
All right. Well, you can check out all the reporting on this at sltrib.com. It's pretty compelling stuff and goes back to the tragedy in question. We need to head to our first break in the show. When we come back, we will turn to some politics and government stories. Call 801-355-TALK with your questions and comments. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor Sheila McCann, reporter Benjamin Wood, and news columnist Robert Gerke. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. All right, well, let's get political now. The legislative session is just 2 weeks away, and Ben Wood, actually, before we go into sort of pre-session stirrings, a legislative story from a couple of years back now that just won't go away, the battle over Utah election law, SB 54, is again in the news thanks to some comments by Utah's Senator Mike Lee. Ben, what did Senator Lee say? And I suppose you should remind us what this law is all about, though it pains me to ask you. But tell us what SB 54 is all about as well, Ben.
Yeah, why don't we get the description out of the way. So SB 54 created our state's dual-track primary nomination system. You can either go through caucus convention and win the support of delegates, or you can gather signatures to qualify for a primary ballot. Senator Mike Lee has decreed this law unconstitutional, and he has called on the governor, lieutenant governor, and various folk in the state to abandon their efforts to defend it in court and let it die a judicial death.
Okay. So he's not a fan of it, and he's asking the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene. What's the
butt in there, when you say he's not a fan of it, he took advantage of it during his most recent reelection. He gathered signatures under the terms of SB 54. So it's important to note that many of the lawmakers who outwardly oppose this bill have, in fact, utilized it in their own campaigns.
Hmm. What's the background on the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court could look at this? I mean, there have been court cases for years over this, right?
Yeah, and with so many things that end up in the courts, I mean, the Supreme Court has been asked to look at it. Whether or not they do is a much different question. I mean, a lot of things are requested of the Supreme Court. Very few things actually land in their chamber. So the Utah Republican Party has essentially exhausted every legal avenue at their disposal and lost at every turn. They're throwing a Hail Mary in a last-ditch attempt to get the Supreme Court to strike this down.
If I could just jump in and drive that
Robert
point
Gricke.
Home. they did go to federal court, and they did win they got one part of the law thrown out that said that the Republican Party had to allow unaffiliated voters to vote in the primary elections. But they lost the rest of the case at district court. They lost the case at the Supreme Court. They lost again at district court. They lost at the 10th Circuit appeal. They lost. They asked the 10th Circuit for a rehearing and lost there. So now we have them going to the Supreme Court, and this is sort of their last avenue. The Supreme Court typically hears about 2.5%, 2.5 to 3% of the cases that are sent to the court, that the court's asked to review. And so it's highly unlikely they're going to, but that's what they're asking for.
There are some other maneuverings on this, though. Another twist is that the House sponsor of SB 54 back in 2014, this is Dan McKay, who's now a senator, he says that he's no longer a fan of the law himself, and he wants to see it changed. Why the change of heart from Dan McKay, Ben Wood? And I should say that, for disclosure, Dan McKay is a volunteer host on the KCPW political program, Both Sides of the Aisle.
Yeah, well, now Senator Dan McKay, over the years, he's expressed some regret over the division this law has caused. He talks about how it's, you know, torn the party apart and cast aspersions on our electoral process. You know, I think what it comes down to is, this has been a perennial and incessant fight that a lot of people are just tired of. We saw a second ballot initiative attempting to ratify this with a public vote that did not make it to the ballot, that might have quelled some of this. And in the absence of that public vote, we still have this legislative compromise that, you know, was hammered out with negotiated parties and never quite satisfied any of the various groups at play here. And so, yeah, it's just been this constant bickering battle that I think many people are wanting to settle one way or the other.
And he wants to see, I mean, he said he would run legislation to get it repealed.
He's planning to sponsor a bill to repeal it. There have been several bills sponsored to repeal this law. It so far has survived to die another day. So we will see. And again, now he's in the state Senate. He's a freshman senator on the lower end of that particular ladder after being a relatively powerful member of the House. So we'll see what kind of influence he carries over to him to the upper chamber.
Robert?
I mean, they have got the repeal efforts through the House. They've always died in the Senate because the Senate leadership basically said, well, we made this deal, we're going to stick with it. At this point, I think they're, given the change we've seen in the Senate, and including Senator McKay and others that, you know, are not fans of this deal, I think it's in some jeopardy this coming session. And then the question becomes, you know, would Governor Herbert veto it? And he has said in the past that he wishes he had vetoed the law, but he thinks we need to stick with it now, if I'm right, Ben. I mean, that's the governor's position.
I guess the question that I have is, is the Republican Party less divided on this than they have been in years past? Like, is there, for a period of time, so you can go to get on the ballot in the Republican Party by going and gathering signatures, or you can still go, and this is an either or both route, you can go through convention. And for a time that was, what was the intent of the law in the beginning? I guess, who put it together and why?
Well, the intent of the law, I mean, so this all started from Count My Vote, running a ballot initiative to create direct primaries where you would follow your candidacy, you would qualify for the ballot, and the registered members of the party would vote on a nominee, circumventing the traditional caucus convention system. People who like that system, people who are empowered by that system, they were worried about this change. And so this deal was hammered out to where you could do either or both. And, you know, you asked at the beginning if these divisions have decreased at all. If anything, I think they've gotten more severe and more entrenched. I mean, we see the party apparatus fighting this with everything they can. Meanwhile, the broader electorate seems okay. I mean, they've consistently chosen candidates who the delegates have not. So there is this push and pull between the central party figures and the broader Republican voters.
Robert Gerke, these are also kind of old divisions, well, now old divisions in the Republican Party, and you sort of highlighted one section of that in a column you wrote this week where Senator Lee is criticizing Governor Gary Herbert over this election law. Senator Lee himself came in on a Tea Party wave, right?
Yeah. I mean, he rode in on that Tea Party wave that got that drove Bob Bennett out. But it's all about who controls the party, and when you think about politics in Utah, who controls the Republican Party generally controls government, and because you've got a supermajority Republican state. The people who are nominated by the Republican Party often win either without opposition or with little opposition from the Democrats in most parts of the state and statewide. And so that's what this boils down to, is who is controlling the nominating process for the Republican Party and consequently who holds office. And this is the fundamental dispute that Senator Lee and the activists in the party have, is that they've had power for a long, long time, and they don't want to give that up. And they say that they're the ones who should be calling the shots in the Republican Party, because they are the Republican Party, not the 600,000+ registered voters who vote Republican Party in the primaries. And so that's the tension here, the back and forth. And I think the studies have shown, we've seen it in real life experience here as well, that these delegates often choose candidates who are outside of the ideological mainstream for the state. They choose more extreme candidates. Now, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. I guess that's up to each individual to decide. I think it's bad. I think the electoral process, the entire design of it, is that you elect people who are representative of the population, because they're the ones who are going to go represent them in the state house.
But aren't those delegates supposed to be representative of the Republican Party? I mean, and maybe it's a comment on that.
The structure, that's actually a really good question. Why, if people are going to their caucuses and choosing delegates who then choose candidates, then shouldn't that ultimately produce a result that reflects that represents the people who went to the caucuses? It doesn't work that way, because the people who end up getting elected delegates are the party activists, the people who are more involved and more active, more passionate, and again, the studies have shown more extreme in their views. And we've seen that so the practical examples that I was talking about. Gary Herbert finished behind Jonathan Johnson at convention, almost got knocked out, ended up going to a primary and beat him by 44 points. Mm-hmm. Now, that shows you that there is a disconnect between the people who go to the polls and vote in a primary versus the people that go to their caucuses, get elected delegates, and choose people at convention. We saw it with John Curtis. He finished fifth in his convention and then went on to beat Chris Herod by a large margin. We saw it with Mitt Romney, who finished behind Mike Kennedy at convention just last year and ended up winning by 43 points. And so beating Mike Kennedy at primary by 43 points. And so there's obviously a disconnect there where the caucuses are not producing results that reflect the voters' views. And so, you know, that's why, as Ben said at the outset, this is why they've created this second path, to give the voters more of an influence on how these processes play out.
And are there, I mean, this is kind of an obvious question, but there are big policy differences in how these factions of the Republican Party, those who are, I guess, kind of part of the delegate system, and then the more moderate candidates that you see emerging from elections, they have different aims when it comes. Are they different sorts of Republicans?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, yes, I think in some instances that's the case. I mean, there was daylight between, say, Gary Herbert and Jonathan Johnson on their policy views. Probably less daylight, frankly, between Mike Kennedy and Mitt Romney. And you know, maybe some daylight on, particularly on the immigration issue. You know, John Curtis is more moderate, particularly on immigration, than Chris Herod was in that third district primary. But you know, if Utah Foundation has looked at this in the past, looked at the issues that are most important to the delegates, and it tends to be issues that are more of more right wing issues, frankly. I mean, you know, the mainstream Republican voters worried about education and jobs and the economy, and the delegates are often more worried about, you know, federalism and state sovereignty issues. And so, you know, that's how those issues have ranked. So it does have a practical impact on the outcome of our elections and our governance.
Ben Wood, just going back to the story that, you know, has to do with SB 54 and the criticism from Senator Mike Lee of Governor Gary Herbert asking him to drop his defense of this. Is the Supreme Court making any, do we have any inkling of what they might do? Or have they said anything about this request to have it heard?
Yeah, they have made some overtures. I mean, the party made the request to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court has asked, or I guess ordered, the state to respond to that petition. So, I mean, if you look at the suite of options available to the Supreme Court, they can just ignore you outright. In this case, they have engaged in the most incremental of steps, which perhaps is indicative that they are looking at this for the time being. They didn't just dismiss it outright.
Okay.
Which is, that was not unexpected, frankly, that the state would have to respond to it. And so we'll see how it ends up going.
And when they respond to it, I mean, what they are going to say about their defense or maybe conceivably not defense of this law, depending upon what happens.
Mike Lee is asking for the state to stand down.
The Tenth Circuit ruling is pretty strong in the sense that it says essentially that the ballot belongs to the public. And if parties want to do what they want to do in their internal functions, electing how they, you know, electing their officials, passing their bylaws and so forth, that's fine. But once they want to get access to the ballot, they have to play by the state's rules. That was essentially the Tenth Circuit's ruling. And it makes a lot of sense.
All right. Well, let's turn now to other stories from ghosts of legislatures past to hints of the session to come. Ben, in this last election in November, there were three voter initiatives, three propositions that Utah voters passed. Medical marijuana, that's already been replaced by lawmakers. Independent redistricting, and we'll see what happens there. And then Medicaid expansion. That last one is what we will kind of focus on today. And I imagine that we will rope in redistricting soon when the session gets underway. But Medicaid expansion would do what it says. It would expand Medicaid coverage to about 150,000 low-income Utahns. First off, when is it supposed to take effect, Ben?
April 1. And when we talk about full expansion, I mean, what we're talking about is lifting the income threshold to a higher level, and anyone below that level, you're in. That's full expansion.
Okay. And that's what the law says should happen. And this is as part of, this would be expansion as envisioned under the Affordable Care Act, which is Barack Obama's signature healthcare expansion. But there's a move to change what voters approved as part of this initiative. Who's trying to prevent this from taking effect, and what sort of alternative is being proposed?
So we saw in the lead up to the election several legislative leaders and lawmakers talking about the costs of Medicaid expansion and how it puts Utah on the hook to pay for medical services for, like I said, anyone below this income level. So now that this has passed, Senator Alan Christensen is planning to sponsor legislation that would impose work requirements, similar to what the state wanted to do before, a cap on enrollment, and a delay so that no expansion would take place until the federal government signs off on that enrollment cap and the work requirements. If going back to what full expansion means, by adding a cap, by adding work requirements, that is no longer full expansion.
Right. It wouldn't be allowed under the way that was envisioned, and so you'd have to get a waiver from the federal government, something the state of Utah tried to do before.
Correct. And after the state's voters said, yes, everybody who is in this category gets Medicaid, that would no longer be the case because you would have to jump through work requirement hoops. And once so many people enroll, you just wouldn't be able to even sign up anymore, despite qualifying.
What is Senator Christensen's justification? Why does he say that he's doing this? What is the driving force?
Well, yeah, the motivation here is this idea that the state cannot afford to do this. Now, the initiative includes a tax increase to pay for this partly through state revenue, as well as hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding that Utah's taxpayers have been paying all this time, but that we do not get because we have not yet expanded Medicaid. So if you talk to supporters of the initiative, they say, no, the money is readily available to pay for this expansion. And of course, the state can pay for anything it wants to if it makes that a priority. But lawmakers like Senator Christians are saying, no, it's simply too costly. It's simply too much a strain on our budget. If we do not put some restrictions on this expansion, it'll bankrupt the state.
There's also criticism. You spoke with the Tribune. I can't remember if you reported the story yourself, Ben, or not, but I spoke with the Utah director of the American Association of Retired People, AARP, who had criticism about the work requirement being sort of brought up again. And can you talk about that, Ben?
Yeah, and it's, you know, from AARP's perspective, work requirements do not work. They point to states like Kentucky and other areas where these work requirements have had little other effect than to just kick people off of Medicaid. I mean, they don't see a lot of evidence that it's actually incentivized work. They see it as a bureaucratic obstacle that leads to people losing their health care. And so their argument is that, you know, if you want people to work, the best thing to do is to get them healthy so that they can work. By imposing a work requirement, you're making it so they can't get healthy and therefore cannot work, and it's counterintuitive from their perspective. The state, they believe that, well, for one thing, the work requirement that the state is proposing, or Senator Christensen is proposing, is intended to decrease costs, which by definition means kick people off of Medicaid. It is built on this idea that there are people who would be working but choose not to and will get into the workforce in order to maintain their health care. It's speculative. We haven't done this yet, so we don't know. But AARP and others are saying that it just goes against the fundamental natures at play when people are not able to work because they're sick.
Let's bring news columnist Robert Gerke in on this. And Robert, the legislature is going to overhaul another initiative passed by voters, a recurring phenomenon now. Was this something that you were expecting to see happen, Robert?
Yeah. You know, there was Senator Jake Andrig was talking about repealing it before it even passed. You know, we saw it with Prop 2, the replacement bill. I think with Prop 4, the better boundaries, you'll see it challenged in court before the legislature tries to tinker with it because they've got some time with that. It's a dangerous game they play because the voters have spoken on this, and it took a lot of effort by the voters to actually get this on the ballot and get it passed. And for now for the legislature to say, well, we know better, you know, we're going to tinker with it here and undo it there is really, I think, a risky move for them. At the same time, I mean, I kind of what the legislature's worried about, what people like Senator Christian are worried about, is that, you know, we can afford it perhaps when the economy's good and we're near full employment in the state and your Medicaid rolls have actually been shrinking in recent years. When the economy takes a nosedive and tax revenues plummet as a result, and your expenses because your expenses skyrocket because Medicaid enrollment goes up, that becomes a real problem. And so how do you prepare for that? And you know, everybody's getting a little antsy right now, sort of worried about we're overdue for a correction in our economy. And so they're kind of trying to prepare for that with the things like the caps.
Ben, can you remind us again how much money is the state's part of this and how much it captures from the federal government?
Yeah, and I sometimes mix up the 8 and the 9. If I recall correctly, it's roughly $90 million in state sales tax revenue combined with $800 million in federal tax dollars.
Okay, so this is just going back to that fundamental question of modifying initiatives, and Robert Gerke, maybe you want to comment on this. Should we expect you talked about the court case, but will the legislature also try and deal with independent redistricting?
I think they wait and see how the court case goes. They'd rather not get that on their, you know, have that on their hands too when they come back for reelection. But I do think that, you know, the other argument I've heard from legislators is, well, my district didn't support Medicaid expansion, and I'm here to represent my district. And so there's some truth to that, because a lot of the districts, especially Republican districts, didn't end up voting for this. It passed with, I think, 53% of the vote. Not an overwhelming margin, but a fairly convincing one. But outside of Salt Lake County, you saw most of the districts voted down. And so these representatives are going up there going, geez, you know, my voters, my constituents didn't want this. So why don't I vote to undo it or to tinker with it?
It's weird. I mean, it's sort of like the electoral map in presidential politics at that point. Ben Wood, any final comments on the story, or any sort of, not that you would predict, but anything we're missing from the story?
Well, just to add on to what Robert was saying about Proposition 4, you know, the next round of redistricting is a couple years out. So there's not the same immediate timetable as we're seeing with Medicaid expansion. You know, that's April. So, you know, for the lawmakers, I think Robert's right. There probably will be less immediate action on Prop 4 just because they have the runway to see if maybe they can do something in the courts.
Okay. And we've seen outside groups already making noise about challenging not just Utah's law, but there are other states that have implemented independent redistricting. And so I think you will see a court challenge to that and try to undo it that way before you have the legislature go in and gut the boundaries initiative.
Okay. Well, we will see what happens in the courts. In the meantime, we have to take another break here on the show. When we come back, more from this week's news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Sheila McCann, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Earlier, we were talking about SB 54, and now we're going to turn to hate crimes, and this show could almost be a rerun from a few years ago. But Ben Wood, the Tribune ran a story about the perennial fight to pass a hate crimes bill or a hate crimes bill that has any teeth. And it turns out that every time someone runs a bill to do that, it runs into the same wall. Maybe to start with, we have a hate crimes law on the books right now, sort of, don't we, Ben?
In theory. You know, people could argue if you have a law that doesn't do anything, do you actually have a law?
Okay. And as I suggested, it doesn't have very much in the way of teeth. Nobody's been prosecuted under this law so far, right?
Correct. It's never been successfully prosecuted.
Okay. And I guess why is that? Vague language, or what does it not allow prosecutors to do?
The language is the primary factor. I mean, the things you have to prove under the law in order to classify as a hate crime, prosecutors say is just a threshold that cannot be cleared.
Okay. Well, let's jump to the ongoing efforts to strengthen our code on hate crimes. Those efforts have floundered repeatedly through the years. Why is that the case, Ben?
Well, and our colleague Taylor Stevens had a story. She spoke to some of the parties here, and there's this idea that there's a reluctance to pass any law that would be perceived as altering the state's non-discrimination bill that it passed a few years ago, the LGBTQ non-discrimination and LGBTQ rights bill. Less clear is exactly how hate crimes would affect that law or why that balance would be upset, but there is this idea that adding protections to minority groups and discriminated groups would somehow alter the scale struck a few years back.
And that law, I mean, that deal was on housing, employment, and housing and employment discrimination.
Correct.
But not so much about enhanced penalties for crimes, right? I mean, which is a traditional hate crimes bill would deal with that. Is that right?
Right. With hate crimes, we're talking about a crime that is committed because a person is a part of a targeted group. Whereas the housing and employment discrimination bill was exactly that. It was meant to protect people from being discriminated against. There are members of the legislature that see a connection there with hate crimes, we do not yet have a very clear answer as to why that is such a sticking point.
But the article that Taylor wrote seemed to suggest or pointed to the fact that lawmakers don't want to give greater protections to LGBTQ people in particular. Is that Maybe that's a question for Robert Gerke.
Yeah,
is
no,
that
I
one?
Mean that, yeah. No, Senator Todd Weiler said that if it wasn't for the LGBTQ protections, this would not be nearly as controversial, which kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. Maybe he said the quiet part loud, because really, if you're not protecting people, everybody's got a sexual orientation. And if you're not protecting people on the basis of their sexual orientation, their race, their gender, we've all got those criteria, those qualities. And if you're not going to protect everybody the same way, then really you're not doing anybody any good. And so, but that is the holdup. And the holdup is also that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been didn't want this passed in 2014. They've been silent ever since then. And even though Marty Stevens, who's the church lobbyist, says, well, we don't have a position on this. You know, actually, that's not exactly how he put it, because if he put it that bluntly, then they might have a chance. But they've had their finger on the scales for a number of years. And until they take a clear position that they're not opposing it, they're going to be perceived as opposing it, and it's not going to go anywhere. That's how much power that the church has at the legislature.
You know, is the central problem, as I understand it, the central problem here is that hate crimes laws, at least in the eyes of many people in faiths within certain religions, see that as a conflict with religious liberties, or at least that was the message of the 2015 compromise, that somehow those two things were linked and maybe opposed to each other. Am I right about that?
Well, there's a perception among some that, you know, why should we protect somebody who a gay couple who gets jumped outside a bar versus a guy in a cowboy hat, you know, and a crime is a crime, and it's all motivated by hate, and you shouldn't prosecute one differently than the other. That's the argument from the opponents, I think, the most rational or logical argument that they make. But, you know, it's kind of hard to dispute that a crime that instills terror in a community or singles out a community has another set of victims and another motivation and another set of consequences. And so that's the argument the prosecutors have said, that they want to be able to enhance that penalty if somebody burns down a church or draws a swastika on a synagogue or things like that, then you're clearly targeting a group of people and instilling fear and terror in that group of people. And so that's where the prosecutor and look, the law enforcement community wants this, the prosecutors want this, and I think, you know, you've got this blockage in the Senate, and his name is Stuart Adams, frankly, who's not going to let this go until you see the church get off the fence on it.
Okay. Ben Wood, proponents also point to proponents who want to see this law passed say there's a need for this, that there is data showing that LGBTQ people are targeted pretty frequently for hate crimes or as victims of hate crimes.
Correct. And not just the LGBTQ community. We see racially motivated crimes. We see, as Robert mentioned, religiously motivated crimes. There are any number of groups that apply under this idea of being targeted that currently the law does not allow prosecutors to go after that crime for those motivations.
Hmm. So there's going to be another try. I mean, there's another try in the offing this year to get a hate crimes bill passed. Senator Daniel Thatcher says he'll run a bill. Do we know what his bill would do? I mean, it would enact a hate crimes bill.
It's the same bill he ran last year. It just provides an enhancement. He calls it a victim selection enhancement. For if you target a group that I was going to say target a group that's protected under the bill, everybody's protected under the bill, but if you choose a victim based on those identifying characteristics in an attempt to instill terror or fear, then it provides a sentencing enhancement. It's the same bill he ran last year, and it has the same support he had last year from cities and counties and prosecutors and law enforcement across the state. And until, you know, it's been interesting to me that we haven't seen Governor Herbert get off the fence on this. Spencer Cox, for all the kudos he gets for, you know, being open-minded, hasn't said a word about it. The Attorney General has been silent on this. And I think if we start seeing maybe those guys get off the fence and you know, speak out in favor of this, maybe you'll actually start seeing some movement. But otherwise, I don't give it much chance.
Meaning, in the meantime, it's in the exact same position that it's been in the past few years that it's been run.
If the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and the church are going to stay silent on this, then we're not going to see it go anywhere.
Ben Wood, any final comments on this story before we maybe squeeze in one more and then turn to our underplayed stories of the week?
No, as Tucker Roberts said, I mean, between last year and this year, there haven't been any particular movement on this issue from the parties involved. So yeah, until something changes, we would expect to see a similar fate.
One more thing, it's totally disingenuous for Marty Stevens to say that they haven't seen a bill, because it's been the same bill for the last 3 years, and every year they've killed it, it's been the same bill. And so to say we can't take a position because we haven't seen it is totally disingenuous. And he's got a phone. He knows how to contact Daniel Thatcher and say, where's the bill? What's the language? It's the same bill he's sponsored every year.
Marty Stevens is the spokesperson for the Church of Jesus Christ.
He's the lobbyist for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and Daniel Thatcher is willing to have the conversation, and the prosecutors are willing to have the conversation. But it's much easier for the church to sit in the dark and quietly smother this.
Okay. Comments from Robert Gerke, news columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. We have just a couple of minutes left before we head to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week, and so maybe we can squeeze in one more topic. And Ben, you've been carrying a heavy workload on the show. I'm going to go back to you with some more questioning here. There have been some startling statistics on deaths by firearms in the state of Utah. And because of that, lawmakers this upcoming session are going to be considering some measures to try to stem the tide. Much of this has to do with statistics on suicide in the state. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, some of the ideas being floated are to make gun locks more readily available, gun safes. And there is still some discussion of a red flag bill or enhancing the ability of the courts to confiscate a person's weapons if they're deemed to be a danger to themselves or others.
How are first, let me just throw out there the fact that anyone who is experiencing suicidal thoughts can call the 24-hour National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. But Ben, how are lawmakers and gun lobbyists, for example, reacting to these proposals, especially that latter one, the red flag bill that you just described?
Well, a lot of those conversations have not quite boiled to the surface yet. I mean, this is something that's been a discussion since the last legislative session. Speaker Hughes, in a big, ornate press conference, called for a red flag bill, and it immediately died. So a lot of that is still being negotiated. There are definitely concerns among the sportsmen's associations and the gun owners' associations, that group. That said, they have participated on various task force and forces and committees looking at potential changes. I think perhaps the gun locks bill and the gun safes bill is probably the easier lift because it's more of a voluntary, self-applied law.
Robert Gerke, we live in a gun rights state. This is a red state, the state of Utah. That's what Ben just described, is that there are easy measures, those that seem more likely to pass, and then those that probably might hit a certain roadblock.
The Utah School Safety Commission looked at the issue of school violence and identified these gun laws as one potential remedy, and you had the suicide task force that looked at it, and they've identified it. Representative Handy I talked to him the other day, and he said this has been the hardest bill he's ever worked on, because you want to have due process, but you want to save lives, and these laws have been shown to save lives, especially in situations where people are potentially suicidal or a threat to themselves or others. But he's getting a lot of pushback from the gun community. They don't, no matter how many checks you put in place, no matter how much process you put in place, they seem to not like the notion of these. I think it's going to put the gun community in a very difficult position, frankly, because they have to argue that somebody's rights to their guns is more important than lives lost. And if this can empirically be shown, and other states have had these for years, Connecticut's had one for, I think, 14 years, maybe longer, actually. And there are cases that we can point to where these are saving lives. And so it's gonna put the gun community in a hard situation to argue that their guns are more valuable than human lives.
All right. So we've done a little bit of a legislative preview on the show. We're going to have to actually leave the story there for now and turn to our final segment, which is the underplayed stories of the week. Thanks for your comments and for your reporting, everyone. But Sheila McCann, do you want to kick us off with an underplayed story of the week? I'll bring you back into the radio show here.
Sure. Yeah. My underplayed story of the week was underplayed because it didn't exist. This week, Tory Greene's trial began up in Brigham City. Tory Greene is accused of sexually assaulting a series of women when he was a student at Utah State University. And we did cover the opening days of the trial. We covered the opening statement, where prosecutors focused on similarities in the women's accounts. And the defense said that Tory Greene is innocent of sexual assault, that these women were angry at him and, in some cases, perhaps were seeking attention. But as testimony continued, it was going over ground that had been covered in a preliminary hearing that we had covered with two reporters. And today our staff is smaller than it was when the preliminary hearing happened. Like most newspapers in this country, our staff is smaller. There are more potential news stories every day than we can ever get to. So we made the decision to not go gavel to gavel. Maybe because I covered courts for years, I wish we could. I wish we could go gavel to gavel. So I miss those stories. But as the defense is getting underway, we will be back in Brigham City. So you can watch for that continuing coverage.
Over the next week, a couple of weeks, actually.
Yes.
All right. Well, a commentary on the size of newsrooms in general and what you can cover and decisions that have to be made from Sheila McCann. Ben Wood, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, the Tribune's been covering the political shift in San Juan County over the last week. Somewhat tangential to that, there's a story this week about an elementary school teacher in San Juan County who has sued the San Juan School District, claiming that funding intended for the education of American Indian students was misused, and also discrimination that she faced, a female teacher, correct, that she faced from a principal who characterized her skin condition as an attempt to become a white man. So it's a very bizarre lawsuit, but just kind of ties into these attitudes among the indigenous population in San Juan County.
Well, I missed that story altogether, and we'll definitely check it out. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
Just kind of piggybacking on what Ben said, we didn't get time to talk about it today, but the San Juan County Commission was sworn in this week on Monday. We now have two Navajo commissioners, for the first time a majority-minority commission. But it's been years in the making, and it's still going on because they're still contesting, they're still challenging Willie Gray Eye's eligibility to vote.
Right.
But this is a historic shift in San Juan County, and probably, you know, obviously more chapters to play out, but it will have profound impacts on the way that county's run.
All right. Interesting pick from Robert Gerke there, a historic moment in San Juan County. I'm going to go with science standards in education. The Utah Board of Education has opened their science standards up to public review. The Tribune's Courtney Tanner reports that parents and teachers can comment on what students should learn about science, including topics like evolution and global warming that have been somewhat divisive in Utah. Apparently, behind the scenes, the board has been debating these new standards and whether or not they go too far in talking about human impact on the climate or if they promote too secular a worldview. You can check out the survey that's available at Courtney's article, sltrib.com. Sheila McCann, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you again next week.